The Guardian.
Last week, the city of Salisbury was thrust into the spotlight when two people were found in critical condition in a local park. Details began to emerge that the man in his late 60s was a former Russian spy. The woman found in a comatose state beside him, his daughter. Speculation mounted that they were poisoned, but by what and by whom?
What we do know is that he was convicted of treason. He pleaded guilty. He got 13 years. He was dispatched to the Republic of Mordovia, which is a famous dumping ground for criminals and for enemies of the state.
There are all sorts of oddities to this that people will speculate about. We have to just wait and see where that conversation goes.
Early reports wondered whether the two were given fentanyl, an opioid drug that can be fatal in small doses. Within days, however, it was revealed by the authorities that they believed it was a nerve agent that harmed the victims.
Now, what we've been hearing from Public Health England is that they do not believe there is a risk to the wider community. There is clearly...
Even more questions were raised. What kind of nerve agent? What might its effects be on others who were in contact with the two? This week, Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May publicly named the nerve agent used in the attack as Novichok. She also pointed to Russia as the likely culprit. So what do we know about Novichok? And how confident can we be that it was the Russians who carried out this attack? I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly. Before we get into the science behind Novichok, let's hear from The Guardian's Maya Wolf-Robinson. She spoke with our foreign correspondent, Luke Harding, about what happened in Salisbury last week.
So let's start at the bench in Salisbury. What happened?
Well, it was a sleepy afternoon, about 4 o'clock. Passers-by noticed a man in his 60s looking at the sky and, according to some accounts, shaking or convulsing. Next to him, a younger woman in her 30s who seemed completely out of it. Clearly, something very terrible had happened to them. First aid were called. The man was driven to hospital in Salisbury and the woman taken by helicopter in a very serious condition.
At what point did we think this isn't quite what it seems?
Freya Church, who's a witness who's spoken about this, who worked at the nearby fitness centre, she thought maybe they were druggies, they were out of it. But what was incongruous was their clothing. They were quite smartly dressed.
Mm.
They looked like a respectable man and younger woman. And so the scene was slightly bewildering. And of course, this became serious when the man's identity was known. So we discovered that this was Sergei Skripal, who had worked in Moscow for Russian military intelligence, the GRU, which is the most powerful and the most secret of the three spy organizations, and one that allegedly Skripal betrayed.
Right.
We got some details from his trial, which was he was arrested in December 2004, put on trial about a year later. The allegation was that MI6, the British Special Intelligence Service, recruited him in 1995. He was making trips to Malta and Spain, and somehow they recruited him, and that he shipped the identities of dozens of agents to his British handlers inside MI6. Now, we don't know if it's true, but what we do know is that he was convicted of treason. He pleaded guilty. He got 13 years. He was dispatched to the Republic of Mordovia, which is a famous dumping ground for criminals and for enemies of the state.
Okay.
And then, almost from nowhere, in July of 2010, when he was 5.5 years into his sentence, he is taken by a guard, handcuffed, driven to Moscow, and put in a van heading to the airport. And of course, what had happened was that there had been a major international incident. The FBI in the States had arrested 10 long-term sleeper agents, including Anna Chapman, the rather sort of glamorous red-headed young woman who were working there undercover. So that network was rolled up, and these spies were being traded with Russia. And as part of the deal, 4 UK and American assets, in inverted commas, were being taken out of Russia, one of whom was Skripal. You would think it was 1983, but actually it was 2010 when this happened. So Skripal was sent to the UK and settled in a four-bedroom, semi-detached house in Salisbury with his wife, Ludmilla, and was leading a very modest, very ordinary life. And people in Salisbury who knew him Many of them thought that he was a retired local government planning inspector, whereas in fact he was a Colonel X in the GRU, which, let's face it, is more glamorous than being a planning inspector.
While the police investigation into who might have been behind this attempted murder is still underway, forensic scientists have been able to make some progress. It was discovered that the two were victims of a nerve agent. I spoke with one toxicology specialist to walk me through the basics of what nerve agents are and how they work.
I'm Alistair Hay. I'm Emeritus Professor of Environmental Toxicology at the University of Leeds. I sit on an advisory board for education and outreach for the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. And I also chair an advisory committee in the UK on the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Alistair, first of all, what are nerve agents?
They are part of a family of organophosphate chemicals. The organophosphates cover a wide spectrum, from the lesser toxic ones, which are used as insecticides, to the extremely toxic nerve agents. Nerve agents only have one purpose, and that is to kill. They are chemical weapons.
And what do they look like? Are they liquids or powders or gases? Tell us a bit about them as substances.
Well, they're primarily liquids. They are disseminated as an aerosol from a munition, from either a rocket, a bomb, or a mortar. And you can be exposed either through inhalation, ingestion, or through the skin.
Do they have a scent at all? Are they easily picked up by our senses?
They vary hugely, and also individuals' perception of them varies. In different tests that have been done, admittedly on very low concentrations, some people describe them as having a sort of fruity smell, some a sort of almondy smell, and others say they can't smell them at all. So smell is really no guide to their presence.
So how do they work? How do they cause the damage that they cause?
Well, all organophosphates inhibit an enzyme at the junction between nerves and muscle, and they block this enzyme, acetylcholinesterase. And the acetylcholinesterase regulates the movement of a chemical messenger across from nerves to muscle and instructs muscles to contract and relax, essentially.
How is that harmful, though?
Well, if the acetylcholinesterase is inhibited and blocked, then you get an excess amount of the neurotransmitter, the nerve messenger, if you like, acetylcholine, and that sends the muscles into spasm. They won't then contract and relax in the normal way. So people collapse, their vision is impaired, and crucially, it is their breathing that's impaired because the chest diaphragm won't expand and contract, and that leads to asphyxiation, compounded by the fact that you get massive secretion of fluid into the lungs. So people are having to breathe through much more liquid in the lungs, and their chest is not expanding and contracting either.
When the Skripals made it to the hospital, the receiving doctors wouldn't have known exactly what had happened to them. But the symptoms will have been a clue, and if the doctors correctly identified nerve agent poisoning, they could have administered a generic treatment there and then.
Ideally, you should get in and treat as soon as possible. There is one chemical, atropine, which directly counteracts the effect of the inhibition of the enzyme. So atropine is a crucial factor, and you keep giving atropine as long as there is evidence of the presence of a nerve agent in an individual. There is another family of chemicals called auxines, and they have a dual role, if you like. They will complex with any nerve agent that may be circulating in the body, in the blood, but they also will combine with any agent that is stuck on this enzyme, acetylcholinesterase, in effect, remove it, restoring enzyme activity. The problem is that not all auxines work with all nerve agents. They tend to be quite specific. So you need to know the identity of the nerve agent. But it's also more complicated because some nerve agents undergo a process called aging. And that simply means that there is no way in which the nerve agent can be removed from the enzyme. final thing generally that you give is diazepam, because quite often people have convulsions after nerve agent poisoning, and diazepam is administered to sort of counteract that. And then there are a whole variety of other drugs that you might require in intensive care.
Do you think that the hospital would have known quickly enough what to administer? Because these people were both found in a bad way on a park bench in Salisbury. They were taken into the hospital when they were reported, but it seemed then, presumably, it would have been some time before the actual agent was identified. I don't know what a hospital can do.
When the father and daughter were taken to hospital, it depends whether the hospital recognized some of the signs of organophosphate poisoning. These would be readily picked up by someone who was experienced and had an idea about organophosphate poisoning. Whether that was the case with the hospital, I don't know. You get pinpoint pupils, some foaming at the mouth, and this would point to a sort of nerve agent along with other signs.
Do people tend to survive attacks like this?
Yes, generally they survive, and there is reporting of very serious poisonings in which the individuals have survived. But those were instances where doctors were on hand immediately and could administer the appropriate antidotes. The complication is if there's any brain damage, and brain damage can occur with, and usually does occur in untreated nerve agent poisonings. And we don't know what the situation is for the father and daughter, whether they have had any damage to the brain. If so, of course, that will complicate their recovery considerably.
Do these agents stay potent when they are on surfaces, if they're in the environment?
They certainly do. All that happens in the environment is that there are processes where the concentration or the amount falls, and the agents disappear in the environment either through evaporation or hydrolysis, that is, a breakdown through contact with water. Their potency is always there, and so it's simply the amount that is gradually falling.
Last week, when doctors first received the victims, very little was known by the public. Many were concerned about the implications of the attack on those who had come into contact with the Skripals and others who had visited the places where they were poisoned. Can we generalise about how potent nerve agents are? How difficult was it for scientists to find the answers that the public and the government both needed? And how did they go about doing it? We'll also hear more about the potential for someone other than the Russian state to carry out this attack. More on that when we return after this break.
The situation in Salisbury is very complicated because it is dealing with very small amounts of material. The risk of it disappearing, of course, is really high. And you're really just trying to work out where this might have been placed.
Hi, Daniel Glazer here. Our latest episode of A Neuroscientist Explains looks back to our evolutionary past and asks, where did social conformity come from?
What we're interested in explaining here is the variability we see out there and in the world before us, the differences between species and, you know, between populations within a species. How can we explain how that arose?
This mode of life is called by the Earth's social scientists the culture of the group.
Is does not mean all. Just because you can explain why something is the case doesn't mean you have to behave that way. But on the other hand, understanding why it has that kind of background may allow you to change it by changing the context.
To have a listen, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search A Neuroscientist Explains on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard about the former Russian spy and double agent Sergei Skripal and details of his life that have been guiding the investigations into the attempted murder of him and his daughter. We also heard from Alistair Hay, Emeritus Professor of Environmental Toxicology at the University of Leeds. He painted a picture of what doctors were faced with in treating the victims in the early days of the investigation when scientists were still processing evidence. Approximately 200 pieces of evidence were collected in this case, but how did scientists do their bit? Alistair tells me there are two approaches to take.
The first one would be to look at the biological samples, blood, saliva, and urine. Given that samples would have been taken from the individuals relatively soon after they were exposed, your chances of finding an agent are considerably greater. And as the individuals were severely poisoned, your chances are even greater still. So you can extract the agent from proteins in the blood, clean it up, and then either put it through a gas chromatography separation system or a high-performance liquid chromatography one and connect that to a mass spectrometer. And the mass spectrometer would confirm the identity of the agent. So that would be the laboratory procedure. What they would also want to do is get environmental samples, because the environmental samples would be present in higher concentrations, and these all help give some guidance as to who made it.
In the past, there have been instances of chemical weapons being used where scientists have been able to identify the origins of a particular agent. I asked Alistair how the Skripal case compares to investigations in war, for example.
Quite often in a war situation, you may still have ammunition embedded in the ground. There may be some records on that munition which helps confirm its identity, you know, who made it. You can look at the munition itself and work out a possible trajectory. And then invariably, if you get to the site soon enough, there's lots of agent present and you can collect it from the munition itself, from soil, from concrete, you know, from any fabric that might be in the environment. And I've done this over the years. In fact, in one investigation I was involved in Iraq in 1992, we confirmed with the help of Porton Down's analytical skill that we confirmed the presence of nerve agent in two soil samples, and that was after a weapon had been detonated 4 years previously.
In terms of trying to trace this back to who did it, I asked Alistair what elements of the evidence actually helped investigators identify the manufacturers of the nerve agent.
Environmental samples will be used for the presence of any precursors that might have been involved in the manufacture of the agent, which helps to confirm its identity. Any unwanted degradation products or other reaction products in the mixture, because these will still be present. And these are things you can only find from environmental samples. So it's that combination of agent, precursors, and other reaction products in the mixture that you get from the environment, your sampling mixture, if you like, that provides some clue as to a possible manufacturer and manufacturing process. That will then be combined with the normal evidentiary collecting process, you know, police detective work. Who might have done it? Who was in contact with the father and daughter? Do we know anything about the movement of these other people who may be linked to the father and daughter? You'll need the combination of the two to help pinpoint a perpetrator in this instance.
So having established that a nerve agent is the cause of the symptoms, leading us to treat this as attempted murder, our role now, of course, is to...
Police have been able to sketch out what the Skripals were up to that day, but they're still looking to fill in some of the blanks, such as how and where the two were poisoned, and of course, who might have done it. Meanwhile, this week, the name of the nerve agent has been released, and the British government, at least, has strong suspicions over who was behind the attack.
It is now clear that Mr. Skripal and his daughter were poisoned with a military-grade nerve agent of a type developed by Russia. This is part of a group of nerve agents known as Novichok. Based on the positive identification of this chemical agent by world-leading experts at the Defence Science and Technology Laboratory at Porton Down, our knowledge that Russia has previously produced this agent and would still be capable of doing so. Mr. Speaker, there are therefore only two plausible explanations for what happened in Salisbury on the 4th of March. Either this was a direct act by the Russian state against our country, or the Russian government lost control of its potentially catastrophically damaging nerve agent and allowed it to get into the hands of others.
The conversation has certainly moved forward, but what do we know about Novichok?
We know very little about the Novichoks. The program was reputedly started in the 1970s or 1980s, but much of it remains obscure. They are a family of organophosphate chemicals, according to the structures that I've seen, and they will operate in the same way as other organophosphates, and that is they inhibit the enzyme acetylcholinesterase, which regulates the message between nerves and muscles. And the agents are reported to have a range of toxicity. So we're talking about many different types of individual chemicals belonging to the one family of organophosphates, and with toxicities ranging from the relatively low, so they might be used as insecticides, for example, to the highly potent, like the nerve agents. And it was obviously one of the latter that was used on the Skripals.
At least some of these Novichoks are described as binary agents. What are they? What's the advantage of having this binary system?
Well, a binary agent simply means, as the definition suggests, two agents being brought together to make a final finished product. So you can use two precursors, which when mixed together will make the finished, say, nerve agent. That binary process is well known. In fact, the United States wanted to use it to make their munitions in the 1980s. The Syrians have used it for production of sarin in Syria, and it's well known. So the advantage is that the precursors are generally much, much less toxic than the finished agent. So if you have the means of bringing them together and a means of mixing them, then obviously that's safer for the individuals involved. But then, of course, you have the difficulty still of how you administer it.
But these chemicals, am I right, these nerve agents were designed in this way so that the precursors wouldn't sort of be intercepted by any bans on chemical weapon precursors and to get around that kind of convention provision. Is that right?
That's possible. Many chemicals are not listed in the chemical weapons schedules and really don't require declarations. Whether this applies directly to the Novichoks, we have to wait and see. I'm unclear on that.
Presumably, these agents could be made anywhere, although historically they were developed in Russia. Presumably, other labs around the world would be able to make them. The structures are public after this Russian former scientist published them.
Yes, that's right. I mean, any competent chemist would simply look at the structures and work out a way of making them. Obviously, from what the government is saying in terms of the preparation being military grade, and my reading of that is simply that it's a pretty pure product. But of course, you know, pharmaceuticals are very pure as well. So military grade simply means that the concentration was sufficient for it to be weaponized, and if it wasn't a weapon, to work effectively.
Is there anything we know about these agents that would help us understand how it might have been delivered? Are these dry powders? Are they liquids? Do we know anything about them?
Well, if you were going to have a binary process, you have to have liquids anyway, because you would only get effective mixing of two precursors in a liquid mixture. That doesn't happen effectively if the agent is a powder. If it was subsequently dried, then that might be how it was administered. But of course, that makes it then very complicated for the individuals who are doing the prep. You've got to have some sort of facilities for doing this, and it complicates things. So it would be much easier for the whole thing to be delivered as a liquid.
How much of a surprise do you think it has been to the chemical agents community that this was the substance that was used in this case? It seems incredibly rare.
It seems very rare indeed. I think it was a huge surprise to those who are knowledgeable about chemical weapons. Little is known about this program, but also because it was developed in the former Soviet Union, it seems to be something that really just, you know, points to Russia as the source. So that raises all sorts of other questions. You know, why would you want to do this sort of thing that brings the attention on yourself? So there are all sorts of oddities to this that, you know, people will speculate about And we have to just wait and see where that conversation goes.
Alistair, is there a role for the OPCW in this incident?
Theresa May has asked the Russians to detail their Novichok program and provide that information to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. The OPCW, for short, is the international organization that oversees the Chemical Weapons Convention. And this came into force in 1997, this convention. There are 192 countries signed up to the convention, and the UK and Russia are two paid-up members. The convention requires countries to declare everything about potential chemical weapons that they hold, and it requires countries to destroy any stocks of chemical weapons they have. And several months ago, the Russians announced that they had destroyed all of their stocks. They had some 40,000 tons of chemical agents. The destruction was done under international supervision. This Novichok program is something new. The British government is saying, we want more information about this. We want the OPCW to be told about it. And the Chemical Weapons Convention has provisions under it to request or require a state that is accused to provide information. It also has a mechanism, if brought into play, to challenge states and actually do investigations itself. So the UK has really upped the ante in this way, but it has also used an international mechanism for confronting the Russians.
Special thanks this week to Maya Wolf-Robinson and Luke Harding, and a very special thanks to our guest Alistair Hay for sticking with us as this story developed. If you want to find out more, we'll include a link to stories written by myself, Luke Harding, and others here at The Guardian as we follow the case. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
Great podcasts from The Guardian. Just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.